Welcome to Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. John Gribben from Barts Cancer Institute in London, UK, and to begin, he discussed a 73-year-old patient with CLL from his practice.
So I guess in CLL, it was always an issue that this is a disease of the elderly, and the most efficacious treatments we used to have were always in clinical trials done for younger, fitter patients. The hugely attractive things about drugs like ibrutinib are how well tolerated they are. So clearly, these have opened up treatment approaches for more elderly people. So case here is a very typical person. She's in her 70s. She presents with early stage disease, picked up at a routine medical. She's asymptomatic for a number of years and watched and waited. And her blood count goes up. Hemoglobin starts to drop, platelets start to drop. And then the usual feature I see that most often drives me to start talking about treatment is this feature of increasing fatigue that people talk about also. And of course, for lots of women, the cervical lymphadenopathy, as occurred in this case, can often be an issue which some people worry about. So the whole question to me here is about, you know, where do you reach the point where you do move from watch and wait to treat? I personally don't like the idea that there's a certain white count that you use to determine when you treat somebody, or that there's a particular size of lymph nodes. Some people find some lymph nodes not a problem. Other people, you know, find the idea of having a few lymph nodes really distressing. So it's all about talking to the patient and finding out how they're coping with their symptoms.
What about this patient? You said she had some lymphadenopathy. Where was it?
She had some lymphadenopathy, mostly cervical. So for her, this was a big issue, that there were big kind of cervical lymph nodes appearing that were increasing in size. She felt them to be very unsightly. She was very self-conscious about it. It made her kind of be aware and thinking about her disease a great deal more. And when she just had the lymphocytosis, she'd been coping with the disease much better. As soon as those lymph nodes started to increase in size and her friends started asking about her disease, she found that to be a feature that she found very, very uncomfortable. But I would say that accompanied with the lymph node swelling was it was the fatigue that was increasing that really made me start to talk to her about treatment options.
I wanted to ask you about that. Do you think that the fatigue sort of goes beyond anemia?
Yeah, I'm very clear in my mind. What also I find fascinating about the CLL patients is how some patients can, I'll talk a little bit later about the very opposite, about somebody profoundly anemic, still bicycling into work every day, and what looks like the same disease burden can have a very different impact on one individual than the other. I certainly am aware that I've got patients with still normal hemoglobins with a relatively modest lymphocytosis who can be very fatigued. And I've got other patients with white counts of 200-300 that I continue to watch because they're completely remaining asymptomatic. So what is it about the disease that impacts and causes this fatigue in some individuals more than in others with what look like exactly the same parameters is something I've thought about. And we don't really know a great deal about why it is. But I kind of talk to my patients about that it's basically about how your body reacts to having that CLL burden on board.
I've actually, I sort of recall, I can't remember, it was MD Anderson or maybe a few places that actually have fatigue clinics.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing, of course, to remember in this disease is that in this case, people have got the disease for years. And what I find is you've got to really question these people quite closely because people start to adapt. And, you know, you find out they're saying, are you feeling fatigued? And they answer, oh, no. And then you go a little bit deeper and you're finding out they're having a nap every afternoon. They're going to bed earlier. They've stopped playing golf. So they're not complaining about it, but they've adapted their lifestyle. And what I invariably find is that people will often say once you start treatment and you get their disease under control and the fatigue goes away, they almost invariably say, gosh, I didn't realize how fatigued I had been until you started treating me and I got better. Because they'd so slowly drifted down into that state of fatigue and got used to it. And a lot of people in this age group also, a bit like myself, tend to kind of say, well, you know, it's kind of usual that I'm a bit more tired as I get older. So people kind of adapt for it, think it's nothing to be concerned about. But this, to me, becomes a real feature that I don't think we've been paying enough attention to in the past.
Can you talk about what her biomarker workup showed and what you consider to be the essential workup for a patient with CLL?
Sure. So when I've got a patient that needs to be treated with CLL, the features I'm concerned about that's going to make me think about the treatments are going to be, you know, the FISH panel. So what's the cytogenetic abnormalities that we're seeing? And in particular, I'm looking for the presence or absence of a 17p deletion or a p53 mutation, because that automatically to me rules out the option of considering chemotherapy at all. We can talk in a minute about whether or not anybody should have chemotherapy at all in that kind of setting. I look for the mutational status of the immunoglobulin gene, whether it's mutated or unmutated, because that also can have an impact both on the response to therapy and help you decide what's the therapy you're going to be using. There are an almost unlimited number of additional kind of biomarkers you could add in to kind of add to those features. But for me, the stage, the cytogenetics, the mutational status would be the most important factors that I would look at.
Could you just briefly comment on P53? We did a survey recently that suggested there's not as much awareness of that as there is the 17P. Can you talk about the therapeutic implication and also the overlap of, do you see P53 without 17P?
So about 5 to 10% of patients who are previously untreated who require therapy are going to have a 17P deletion. An approximately same number of patients will have a T53 mutation without a 17P deletion. So you could actually say they're about equivalent numbers. Now, most patients with 17P deletions will also have a P53 mutation. So there are more patients with P53 mutations than there are with 17P deletions. But functionally, the results are the same. The impact in terms of the way in which the disease progresses, it's a poor prognostic feature. Not thinking about therapy, but just thinking about the way in which the disease progresses. But where it stands out most is both 17P deletions and P53 mutations show a really poor response to chemotherapy, as you would expect. Now, you raised an interesting concept here, saying at least in CLL, people think about 17P deletions. Well, of course, P53 mutations are something we see in lots of different cancers. We see it in lots of different B-cell malignancies. But funnily enough, it's only in CLL that it's already changed the therapy that we're doing. So rather than say I'm disappointed that people don't know enough yet about P53 mutations, I'm actually heartened to say that actually a lot of people already know about 17P deletions. Therefore, educationally, to then be able to say, or a TP53 mutation. So I think you could be thinking about these almost interchangeably. Everything you think and you know about 17P deletion applies to a patient with a P53 mutation.
Just one more issue about to treat or not. So I'm going to tell you about a case I just heard about. The general medical oncologist told me about a patient with CLL who was, I think he was in his late 50s, young, and completely asymptomatic. She's following him. His white count goes up, gets up to about, I think, 180,000, still asymptomatic. And the patient was very well informed, read, walked in and said, I would like ibrutinib. I really don't like having this disease. So first of all, how would you react? Have you had that happen to you? And this man, as it turned out, had a great insurance. He wasn't going to have to pay anything. How would you react if a patient said that to you?
Sure. I think it actually is something that we see all the time. As you know, I worked in the States for a long time, and now I'm working back in Europe. And the funny thing is, it was always clear to me that the average American patient hates the concept of watch and worry, as they tend to call it. They don't. It's not in the American psyche that you've got cancer and you do nothing about it. The European approach tends to be much more, oh, it's great, I don't need therapy. It's quite different how you see the two sides of the Atlantic viewing the same news in a slightly different way. But you're absolutely right. There are some people in whom the concept of being treated is what they're most afraid of. And there are other people in whom the concept of having the disease can be a real big issue for them. As much as possible, what I try to do is have a discussion and a dialogue with somebody. Treating anyone with CLL is about this. There's almost never a time when you say you have to be treated today. So all we're talking about now is the when. As always, the issue we have right now is we still don't have any data that tells us that earlier treatment is better than later treatment. There's a great trial being done, the CLL12 trial, which took high-risk patients with CLL, giving them early treatment or watching and waiting them until the classical IWCLL criteria were achieved. That study's fully accrued, but it'll probably take years for it to actually read out for us to see the data. Until we see that data, we don't yet know whether starting treatment is beneficial. So I would be having a discussion with your patient, be saying, you know, you've got to remember is that we certainly hope you're going to have a very long duration of response, but there are mechanisms whereby you can become resistant. The sooner we start the drug, the sooner that process of resistance might start, and that you could land up, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years from now being in a worse position than you are. Now, all of this will change if the CLL12 data tells us there is a benefit of giving somebody ibrutinib earlier. Now, going back to your scenario, if I have that discussion with that patient and he tells me that, no, here's all the information, he feels it, and he still wants to be treated, I'd be asking him, what is it about the disease that, you know, what's the feature for him that wants to be treated? And if I'm convinced that he's now been educated about what the risks of doing that are, and for him, that's an indication for treatment, you know, as a clinician feel, I've got to listen to my patients and not just acquiesce to what they want, but if I could conceive of circumstances where I would treat that patient, but I'd certainly be personally at the moment trying to talk him out of it. And if I couldn't, I'd probably say, okay, let's go with it.
This CLL12 trial, when you say high risk, these are mainly 17 p53 and it's ibrutinib?
No, so high risk was defined in a number of different ways. So it had included 11q mutational. So you added up the points. And if you were low risk, so you didn't have any high risk features, so if you were mutated, 13q deleted, normal karyotype mutated, you would not be treated. If you had 11q deletions, 17p deletions, mutated immunoglobulins, and you had enough points accrued from each of those features, and you're considered high risk, you were randomized to receive immediate treatment versus continued watch and wait. So it's not just the 17p deleted patients that are in that trial. We'll have a bigger population of other so-called higher risk features incorporated within it.
But just to clarify, right now, in a, you know, not common situation, but it does occur in the patient who's 17p at diagnosis and needs to be treated and does not meet the usual criteria for symptoms or treatment, the 17p alone or p53 would not get you to treat.
No, absolutely not. There are individual patients who will continue to have a very long period of time. I think overall, you say statistically, these patients are much more likely to get to treatment sooner. But of course, it's also the case that these are the group of patients in whom ibrutinib resistance itself is more likely to develop. So all the more reason to not be using up the drug time at a time the patient doesn't need it.
So I've got a great ending to the story. And as I was listening to you, it has a different ending now of this case I was telling you about. Because what happened, and this man didn't have lymphadenopathy, the patient, but he did have the high white count. So the doc gives the man ibrutinib, goes into complete remission, no tolerability issues. He's doing great. He's super happy. But now that I think about it, when she told me about this case, she said, you know, one thing that was interesting, his hemoglobin was not that low. It's like in the 12s. But he said he had much more energy. She said, I don't know if it was psychologic or whatever, but it kind of reminded me of what you were just talking about, fatigue, that maybe he sort of had fatigue and didn't realize it.
Yeah, I think that's very, very likely. And also, of course, a lot of us seen when we're giving patients ibrutinib, I've always assumed it's due to getting rid of the CLL, but you do wonder whether the ibrutinib itself is one of the side effects it has, is kind of making people feel a little bit better on the drug.
Really?
Because one of the issues is I've seen, you talk about, you know, the lymphocytosis going away, but of course, when we start ibrutinib, we often see the opposite, the lymphocytosis really shooting up. And I've seen people start to feel better at a time when their blood counts are getting worse. But there's something about the way that biologically this drug is working. My own personal view is that it's probably working because of the biology of how it's changing the CLL. But who knows exactly what the mechanisms might be?
You mentioned P53, 17P, and IGVH mutation status. And kind of I've been hearing that those are really the three things, that these predictive factors that are really critical in making the decision.
Yeah, because they're prognostic and predictive.
Right. Okay. So here's the one subset that I find interesting, which is 17p, p53 negative, IGVH mutated, and a younger patient.
Yeah.
And what I hear from investigators is FCR, for obvious reasons, you know, try to throw them into long-term remission. And what I hear from docs in practice is we hate FCR and we don't want to use it. Any thoughts about that conundrum?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've got a case here, the 49-year-old guy here, which would be a very good way to illustrate exactly that issue. He is exactly this situation, doesn't have a 17p deletion, doesn't have a p53 mutation, but this time he has mutated, so it's the other way around. So the whole question of the idea of chemotherapy, so chemotherapy works well in the mutated patients. The concern you have is we already know the FCR works much less well in the unmutated patient. This is a young patient with a mutated immunoglobulin, and he tells me categorically, I don't want chemotherapy, I want ibrutinib.
What was his life situation? He was working?
Yeah, he's a 49-year-old TV executive, but looks and acts a lot younger than even that. Bicycling into work every day, hemoglobin of 6 when I'm seeing him, and he's going skiing, he's bicycling into work, he's going to the gym. Very little in the way of the opposite of what I talked about earlier about these people having really lots of fatigue. But he really wants to avoid chemotherapy. Now, I'm talking to him about the fact is, you know, this is the subset of patients in whom FCR has the potential to cure. Now, the C word isn't something we've been able to use in CLL before, but very clear data emerging that about 60% of patients that are mutated are going to have these very durable remissions, have eradication of MRD detectable disease, and to all intents and purposes, probably cured. I had long chats with this guy about, look, if I were you, you've got a chance of going for cure with chemotherapy. But this is a young, fit guy, and I gave him 6 cycles of FCR, and he struggled. He found it tough to get through 6 cycles of therapy. He got quite debilitated by the chemotherapy, and it's taken him months after the chemotherapy to really feel he's getting back on his feet. He happened to got a very severe rash that probably was associated with cotrimoxazole rather than the chemotherapy that probably didn't help him. But for those docs that you're talking about that say, I don't like giving FCR, I hear what they mean. This is not an easy regimen to get somebody through. I use a lot of growth factor support for my patients to get them through it. And when I'm talking here about curative intent, the same way that I would with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, where somebody's starting to run into some problems, we want to keep pushing hard here because I don't want to just palliate your symptoms here. I'm going for cure. I really want to keep this dose intensity. I want to treat you every 28 days. I don't want to dose reduce because I don't want to compromise the likelihood of being able to cure you.
And I see that he actually is MRD negative.
He is MRD negative now.
Could you comment a little bit about the use of MRD assays, what type of assay, and is it something that you think should be done in a non-trial setting?
Yeah, so I think there's a huge amount of data now that becoming MRD negative in this disease has huge prognostic significance, particularly after chemotherapy. The routine way that I do MRD in my patients is that, now, I did a bone marrow after the end of his therapy to look for the MRD question particularly. Nobody likes having bone marrows, and I certainly don't routinely perform more bone marrows to look for MRD. How I do it is I look in the peripheral blood. We look by flow assays, by multicolor flow. It's a sensitive technique. And as long as a patient remains negative in their blood, I don't then, you know, go on and do anything more than that. So I'm monitoring the patients routinely in their blood. You can do it by PCR, but, you know, I think it's a good enough assay with using the 6-color flow cytometry assay that we use kind of pretty routinely now to monitor patients' blood. And I'm able to tell patients that they're negative. To really tell a patient that they've had the best response, you really do need to have a bone marrow because not everyone who's negative in blood is going to be negative in bone marrow. It's like going another level deeper. So in his case, where we were going for cure and I wanted to see how good the response was, I looked in his bone marrow and was able to tell him he was negative in his bone marrow. Now, lots of the clinical trials then go on and do more serial bone marrow biopsies. I don't think that's something that people are going to want to do in routine practice, and I don't think it's something my patients want to subject themselves to. So I monitor the blood. And if the blood becomes positive, then you can start looking in a bit more detail.
So, and I see this man is now 18 months post FCR, still MRD negative. I don't know if he's asked you this, but if he did ask you statistically what the likelihood is at this point that he's going to relapse, what would you say? In other words, what is the chance he's cured at this point?
Well, when I started off treating him, I told him he had a 60% chance of being cured. 18 months MRD negative rate, he's already gone past about half of that risk of relapsing. So should say now he's got, you know, an 80% plus chance of being cured at this point.
So what I'm really curious about is how this man feels about having gone through all this. Is he glad he did, or did he wish he had ibrutinib?
Well, he certainly, as we're getting further away from the treatment, he's now glad he did. He was not giving me a good time at the time he was struggling through the FCR and thinking about I could have been having ibrutinib. Now, of course, that he's been off treatment for a year, he's beginning to see the benefit of being off therapy rather than being on some continual therapy for the rest of your life. A very different conversation than having, you know, this woman, the first one, who's now 75. The concept for her of staying on therapy, you know, she's taking blood pressure medication and she's taking ibrutinib, and she thinks of it in the same way. I take a tablet to control my blood pressure. I take a tablet to control my CLL. But giving somebody in their 40s and 50s lifelong therapy, it becomes quite a bigger implication.
So we'll talk about whether or not maybe that might not be happening in the future. But I'm going to ask, and I don't know if we really have a great answer to this, but I would imagine a well-read patient or maybe a health professional might ask this question, which is, you painted this picture for this particular subset, mutated, 70p and p53 negative in terms of cure with FCR. If somebody were to say to you, what about BR or obinutuzumab bendamustine? Do you see cures there?
Well, yes, but there are two things. The plateau's lower than it is with FCR. And the plateau's shorter at the moment because we don't have the same duration of follow-up with the BR, and we certainly don't have that data with the BO. The bendamustine-obinutuzumab combination is certainly a bit more toxic. There's a more neutropenia when you use the obinutuzumab compared to the rituximab. So we'll have to see what the longer-term follow-up is. But on the CLL10 study that compared FCR with BR, and in the subset that are mutated, the same thing is true. The mutated patients do much better with BR or BO than the unmutated patients do. But I would argue that they still do less well than the FCR patients.
So this woman now has been on ibrutinib at 420 milligrams a day for the last 3 years. Can you talk about what happened when you started the ibrutinib, both in terms of the disease as well as tolerability?
So the first thing she noted was that the lymph nodes shrunk very quickly. And that's one of the features. It's a kind of very positive, reassuring thing of the way this works. So one of the things that ibrutinib does is it changes the adhesion properties of the CLL cells. So they leave the lymph nodes and go into the blood. Now that gives the lymphocytosis. But of course, the patients don't see the lymphocytosis until you do the blood test. What they see are the lymph nodes shrinking, and she saw them shrinking very, very quickly. So when I saw her back for her first visit after starting ibrutinib, she was really excited. Because if you remember, the things she was most concerned about were these unsightly nodes. And to her, you know, she comes in, she's going, oh, John, look at this. This is incredible. You know, the nodes have gone, the nodes have gone. So that's the thing I think that's most striking for patients you're treating with ibrutinib is how fast these lymph nodes respond. With that, of course, comes that rise in lymphocytosis. And the important feature here is to remember that, you know, this is an expected side effect with this drug. The second thing is, you know, people get very nervous about very high white counts. Am I going to get leukostasis? Leukostasis is something that you see with CML and myeloid leukemias where the cells are sticky. CLL cells are much less sticky, and ibrutinib-treated CLL cells are less sticky again. That's the whole feature. They're not sticky. So you really do not see. So I think the doctors get nervous about the lymphocytosis, but experts in the field don't. And we're quite used to seeing, you know, the counts go very high. A concern that some people have is that, oh, you know, I'm starting somebody with a white count of 200 and plus and they've got some lymph nodes. How high is the lymphocyte count going to go? And I think what we can say is we have not seen any real risk, no matter how high that count goes. And of course, it's also of short duration.
I see this lady was hypertensive, well-controlled prior to ibrutinib, required more antihypertensive medication.
Yeah.
Is that something you see with ibrutinib? Do you see people developing hypertension who never had it?
Yeah, so probably hypertension's the one side effect that increases in time with ibrutinib therapy. It's not a big proportion, but it's a proportion that increases. Many of the side effects with ibrutinib are quite transient, go away. I'll tell a lot of people that, you know, things like the GI upset, mild rashes, you know, some joint pains, those are things which can go away. The atrial fibrillation tends to occur really early or doesn't. Hypertension is the one feature that I certainly see increasing in numbers and in severity of the patients. And I certainly, one of the features with many of my ibrutinib patients is, of course, I'm not seeing them so often. I'm giving them a 3-month prescription at a time and sending them off. So I'm always telling my patients or general practitioners to monitor people's blood pressure. Second reason, of course, is that it's stressful for people to be coming into the cancer centre. Monitoring their blood pressure every 3 months when somebody's had to struggle to get into the cancer centre and they find it all stressful isn't the most ideal way of monitoring people's blood pressure. So I kind of actively involve patients' own practitioners in terms of saying, just be aware that this is a signal you've got to look for and think that you may have to increase the antihypertensive therapy.
What's the putative mechanism of the hypertension that you see?
Nobody really is clear. It's probably an off-target kinase effect. It's probably not mediated by BTK itself. The issue is whether or not next generation BTK inhibitors will have exactly the same features is something that we'll have to see. But at the moment, it's probably thought to be an off-target effect.
And this lady, any evidence of bleeding? One thing you hear about are people getting bruising on her arms. Did she have that?
She is certainly aware that if she knocks herself, even kind of a little minor knock, she'll notice some early bruising. That can be a concern for some people. This particular lady here, she's just like, oh, yeah, yeah, I'm a bit clumsy. I just notice there. I know it doesn't do me any harm. But absolutely, this kind of easier bruising. And of course, some of these elderly ladies have kind of thinner skins and tended to bruise more easily even without ibrutinib, so it can be an even bigger problem in this kind of patient population.
So she sounds kind of like, you know, myeloma, they talk about the very elderly and the elderly, and she sounds like, you know, pretty good shape, you know, 75 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
She has some other things. So what about chemoimmunotherapy? Did you discuss that with her? For example, you know, one of the regimens that's used in older people is obinutuzumab chlorambucil. What about that? And also the advantage, and how did she see it in terms of shorter therapy?
Sure. So I always have a conversation with people in this kind of setting about, you know, you've got two choices. You've got a fixed duration of therapy, or you've got, you know, the continuous therapy. And I guess in my own mind, I'm kind of pushing it a little bit less, because what's also clear, of course, is we see much better results with the ibrutinib frontline than we see using it for relapse. So in patients like this, in whom the funding isn't going to be an issue because she's got good insurance that's fully covering the drug and has full access to it, that doesn't become a factor for her particular circumstance. And I'm kind of feeling more and more that, you know, for these sorts of patients, ibrutinib can really be the answer here.
So, and that kind of brings me to this sort of algorithm that I kind of, you know, we, as you know, we ask these questions, survey questions, we ask everybody, you know, kind of what they do in their practice. And as I've been asking these questions of first-line therapy, how it varies with biomarkers, I'm starting to see an algorithm. I want to know to what extent you might agree with it, which is for the patient who needs to be treated, you can identify the people who are 17P or P53. It's going to be ibrutinib and venetoclax, assuming no other issue. But for 17P negative and P53 negative, if they're mutated, IGVH mutated, then we get into the whole argument about FCR that you went through. But for the remainder, where, you know, for example, BR was something that was often used in patients like that, what I'm hearing is ibrutinib followed by venetoclax rituximab, period. What do you think?
So the whole issue about using chlorambucil obinutuzumab is that, you know, until we had ibrutinib, that was clearly a much more effective therapy for these patients in whom FCR was never going to be an option. So it was an advance. Unlike the FCR argument we had with our patient, where I'm talking about potential cure, there isn't a subgroup of patients in whom I think, you know, oh, chlorambucil obinutuzumab is really going to cure you. I think the mutated patients are going to have a longer duration of response. They may have an increased likelihood of becoming MRD negative, but I'm still not talking cure. So I'm still talking about you're going to give them the therapy and they're going to get ibrutinib at some point in the future. The median time to relapse after chlorambucil obinutuzumab in the CLL-11 trials, getting up towards 3 years. So you're not talking about these very, very long durations of response that you see with FCR. So I guess probably what you're seeing in the field is more and more clinicians moving right up front to ibrutinib. And of course, the clinical trial data supports it. The randomized trials that have looked at ibrutinib versus chlorambucil clearly demonstrate superiority of ibrutinib. Inside the clinical trials, even the crossover going back to allow the patients to then go on to crossover to ibrutinib still had an inferior outcome. Now, that's a clinical trial vagary that people have to be aware of. The criteria in a clinical trial to crossover is a much higher threshold than we would use in our clinical practice to retreat a patient. So you had to have an independent review committee say that they had progressed above where they were before to do that crossover. So that's a difficult point. But there's no doubt in my mind that ibrutinib is a superior treatment up front than chlorambucil obinutuzumab. And I guess the other issue was, you already kind of alluded to it, is part of the reason why before I might have considered chlorambucil obinutuzumab more is that then I had ibrutinib as a salvage. And if ibrutinib was all I had, I wouldn't want to go from ibrutinib and when the patient relapsed, think about chlorambucil obinutuzumab, because that's not where I would think about it. So when I didn't have a next option, I'd consider chlorambucil obinutuzumab, then ibrutinib. But now that I've got venetoclax or venetoclax plus rituximab, my algorithm then becomes ibrutinib, then venetoclax. So I've got a fallback circumstance. So I've become, I guess, like many other of my colleagues, increasingly comfortable of using ibrutinib frontline. I've got a salvage second line for those patients for whom it doesn't work, or a patient who really gets a complication of the treatment and has to come off it.
So I want to ask you actually about your 64-year-old man who ended up getting venetoclax, who was also DEL17P and P53 negative. But before I do, can you talk a little bit about the data? I mean, the data was presented at ASH, and almost immediately we saw investigators changing what they did. I mean, you heard talk about practice changing. I call that practice changing because we asked them what they did, and they started doing it. So first of all, can you talk a little bit about the data? This is the Murano trial.
Sure. So the Murano trial is a very interesting trial for a number of reasons. So as you've already alluded to, it's venetoclax rituximab versus, in that trial, bendamustine rituximab. Why it's an important trial? It's one of the first trials in which, you know, a standard chemoimmunotherapy approach. So a BR was our standard second line therapy. So if you like, our best chemotherapy, it went against a modern targeted therapy, the BCL2 inhibitor. So it's the first trial in which these drugs went up against not the chlorambucil that nobody uses anymore, but went up against our very best treatment. The second thing that's really interesting about the Murano trial is this fixed duration of therapy that they chose to do. So that trial gave people venetoclax, they gave 6 months of rituximab, and they gave 2 years of venetoclax and then stopped. And it wasn't an MRD-driven stop point. It wasn't like saying, let's stop the drug in those people who are already MRD negative. It was, let's give everyone the drug for 2 years and then stop. The results very clearly demonstrated that venetoclax and rituximab was completely superior to BR. And why I think this is, you know, practice changing is that means that, to my mind, there is no role for chemoimmunotherapy second line anymore. We've done a head-to-head trial with our best treatment and chemotherapy lost wholeheartedly. So to me, that's my rationale for saying I no longer consider chemoimmunotherapy second line for my patients. There are better options out there.
Yeah, I mean, the difference in those curves and the hazard rate was, I think it was less than 0.2, or shocking.
And of course, well, there's also the vagary of that trial, is that there's what you and I would call an overall survival advantage. And
right,
we've all got used to now thinking about this thing called an alpha spend, which none of us knew very much about before, that just meant that because of the statistical plan, the company can't say that's an overall survival advantage. But I think every clinician would say that curve is an overall survival advantage, and I know which curve I want to be on.
So one of the issues, of course, with venetoclax that's been out there ever since we first started hearing about it is tumor lysis syndrome. And it's interesting because I see that this 64-year-old man that you gave this combination to actually had bulky lymph nodes and was high risk for tumor lysis syndrome. Can you talk a little bit about what his status was when you started the regimen and how you approach preventing TLS in him?
Sure. So one of the features, I mean, remember when the first patients that went on to some of the earlier clinical trials of venetoclax, there were deaths from tumor lysis syndrome. And certainly the company, very appropriately under those circumstances, you know, put up their hands in almost horror. But every clinician I knew was kind of excited. I mean, very sorry for the patients. But the issue is you're getting tumor lysis syndrome because the drug is so effective. There's a very good plan in place, which we have now in terms of saying what is the risk for tumor lysis syndrome and what you should do. It's in the...
And that's actually in the package insert.
It's in the package insert. Not many of us look at the package insert, but this is the part of the package insert you should look at.
This is an all-time package insert. It was that table. But the thing that was interesting is it really comes down to lymph node size and white count, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you fall into low-risk category, intermediate risk, and high risk. And irrespective of what risk you are, the important thing to take away from venetoclax is you do this ramp up. You start at that 20 milligram dose and you, over the next 5 weeks, build up the dose to the 400 milligrams. I should say that more carefully. You build it up over 5 weeks if you don't hit the parameter that says you should stop and go a little bit more slowly. The issue is managing tumor lysis syndrome is to think about it and plan for it. This is not a circumstance you react to. This is one you proactively try to manage these patients with. So you give the patient the 20 milligram dose. You've done their bloods before you start. You look at other features like the renal function, like other biochemical abnormalities that may be there. And you repeat the bloods 8 hours later. And you look to make sure there's no biochemical evidence of tumor lysis syndrome. And what I'm looking for in particular is the potassium going up. And what I like to do is I use the plot feature on the labs. What I'm looking for isn't just whether the potassium's gone out of the normal range, but is there any change at all in terms of, do I have to consider, you know, other features in this? And for a high-risk patient like this, I admit for the first 2 weeks, I actually admit the patient. I'm giving lots of fluids. I gave respuricase to this particular patient because he was high-risk. And I monitored very carefully, and I repeat the labs the next morning. And you certainly want to make sure you've seen the lab before you even give the next dose of drug to make sure that, you know, it's safe to escalate at all. The feature that we see here is that with the implementation of this more modern tumor lysis syndrome approach, that is, giving the dose escalations, thinking about the risk factors, and thinking about the appropriate measures to prevent tumor lysis syndrome, there haven't been subsequent deaths from tumor lysis syndrome. And in fact, what we're seeing now is even biochemical tumor lysis syndromes becoming, you know, a thing that we don't see as much as we used to. I guess that people have to be aware of, you know, you've got to be cautious about it, and you can't get into being complacent about it. And although we admit this patient for the 20 and 50 milligram dose, you still, at the third and the fourth week, as you're going up in doses, can't be complacent about just sending that patient away. I made sure that I had the 8-hour labs and I looked at them carefully and that I knew that it was safe for him to continue that dose and go off. But I have to say, once I get a patient onto the 400 milligram dose, tumor lysis syndrome isn't something that I have to be concerned about anymore. It's only a feature as I'm dose escalating the patient up to the dose. By the time I get to the 400 milligram dose, the tumor bulk has almost invariably decreased enough that even high-risk patients aren't high-risk anymore, particularly when you're then also adding in rituximab, as we did in Murano.
I was curious that you gave this man Rasburicase. I'm not sure how clear the package insert is about that. Now, he was high risk. He had a white count of 60,000, nodes as big as 11 centimeters in the abdomen. And you said he was in the hospital for 2 weeks, because I thought these patients are in...
No. He's in hospital on the day of the dose escalation. So I'm bringing...
Just the day.
I'm bringing him in, doing labs in the morning, giving him his venetoclax, doing an 8-hour lab and a 24-hour lab. Then I discharged him, and then I readmitted him the next week.
Got it. Okay. And it looks like he did great, and now he's just on venetoclax?
Now he's on single-agent venetoclax. He's finished his rituximab period. For him, of course, it was particularly attractive. He did not like the concept of continuous therapy for the rest of his life. He personally likes the concept of the 2-year point. Now, one of the big issues that we have here is we don't have a huge number of patients on Murano that have yet been reported that are off that 2-year time point. The New England Journal paper was reassuring, and that line still looked pretty steady, but we're going to see at ASH the next update of Murano to see, are those patients going to fall off the curve? And is the concept of a 2-year fixed duration the right thing to do, or should we be doing something different? Lots of clinical trials using this approach use an MRD endpoint to say if you're MRD negative, you can stop, and if you're MRD positive, you continue on therapy. That isn't what Murano did. And they didn't do it that way because the company felt that, you know, MRD monitoring isn't quite ready and in prime time anymore. So would people kind of feel comfortable about using it? But we might, depending on what we see with the Murano data, we might be going back to be talking about, well, there are patients that can stop, but maybe there are other patients that should continue.
So agree or disagree, once you get the patient on venetoclax through the tumor lysis risk, their quality of life and the problems they run into are substantially less than you see with ibrutinib.
Yeah, I think that would be my sense. The toxicity profile of people on venetoclax once they're on that 400 milligram dose is really very tolerable. I will say, I've had a lot of patients I've treated on clinical trials or the ibrutinib venetoclax combination, where I really was concerned about now you're getting people taking 8 tablets a day and what was the toxicity profile going to be like? And all of those patients also did very well in the combination. But my sense is, yes, the kind of little niggly things that ibrutinib patients start to complain about. They don't complain about it when their lymph nodes are shrinking, but when somebody's been on the drug a little bit longer, little things that persevere can become a real nuisance. And I certainly see less of that on venetoclax than I do on ibrutinib.
And that kind of leads into the issue of tolerability toxicity with BTK inhibitors and also the issue of acalabrutinib. But before we get into that, you mentioned ibrutinib venetoclax, and certainly there seems like a gigantic excitement about that. After I hear them talking, I'm like, why aren't we using this now? But can you just kind of talk about what we know about that combination, including what was presented at ASCO, and whether you think this is kind of where we're going to land maybe in a couple of years?
Sure. So in the original trials, we're in the relapse setting, and people got really excited where we saw the ibrutinib venetoclax combination had really, really high response rates, and probably even more excitingly, drove people to MRD negativity at high rates. And that in those studies, you could actually get people off the drug altogether. So, of course, for many people, the concern is you've got one very expensive drug, you've got another very expensive drug. Why should they add them together? Well, if you can add them together and get people to stop, after a couple of years, that has become a cheaper combination than giving one drug continuously. The second issue then moved to, you know, the upfront trials, and we've seen data now presented at both ASH and now at ASCO, of groups of patients treated, previously untreated patients, receiving as their first therapy the ibrutinib venetoclax combination, truly spectacular response rates. And again, getting people off the drug. I guess one concern and one little caveat that people still have in the back of our minds is we have to see the long-term follow-up. There's always the risk if you've used, remember I talked about earlier, I was happier to use ibrutinib when I knew I had a fallback. If you've used your two best drugs together and then the patient relapses, do you treat with ibrutinib and then venetoclax? Do you go back to the combination? What's the response rate when you retry? We don't know that yet. And the reason we don't know that is because the patients treated with the ibrutinib venetoclax combination have done so well, we haven't got a cohort of patients that we've had to retreat yet. So we just don't know. The second thing would be that if, let's say, somebody was going to get 10 years with ibrutinib and then get another 7 years with venetoclax if you used it continuously, that potentially means 17 years of duration of response that you could be adding. We haven't treated anyone with ibrutinib venetoclax in whom we can say, I know what your outcome is going to be like 17 years from now. So we still have to see how durable those responses are. But I've got to say, so far, like everybody else, I'm really excited by that combination. This could be the answer we've been waiting for, to really see very high response rates and potential eradication of disease in many of these patients.
What's the schedule of the combination of ibrutinib and venetoclax? And do you use the ibrutinib to debulk the patient first to lower the risk of TLS?
So all the clinical trials that use the combination start with ibrutinib monotherapy. A little fine-tuning to look at is different trials use different durations of doing that. But you're absolutely right. The issue here is you are looking to debulk the patient before you start. Now, on those clinical trials, when we first started doing them, we were admitting the patients for tumor lysis monitoring. But I have to say, patients that have had that run-in with ibrutinib first that start the venetoclax, I won't say you can relax because you still have to think about tumor lysis syndrome. But by the time you've got into that pre-run-in with ibrutinib, usually for about 6 to 8 weeks on the different clinical trials, it looks very safe to be able to add in venetoclax at that time point. You still do the ramp up. You don't go in at a 400 milligram dose. You do that 20, 40, you know, 20, 50, 100, 200, 400 ramp up that you would normally do. But certainly all the patients I've treated on that combination, I haven't seen any real problems in being able to add in the venetoclax when you've already done that.
So let's finish out talking about the issue of tolerability issues with BTK inhibitors and also the potential of using other BTK inhibitors besides ibrutinib. And obviously, at least in the United States, acalabrutinib is now approved in mantle cell. It's been studied in CLL. Maybe to get into that, we can hear about your patient. I don't think it says in the age of the patient.
Oh, sorry. That patient was in his 60s. It was a man. For him, the big issue here was he was truly refractory to FCR chemotherapy. So he was in his early 60s. We treated him with FCR and had no response whatsoever. Now, this is the data, the sort of patient that before we had these BTK inhibitors around, this is the kind of patient that Michael Keating had published from the MD Anderson would have, you know, a median survival of less than a year. This is a group of patients going to historically do extremely poorly. And of course, along comes ibrutinib, and we're able to say, well, now we've got a good therapy for a previously completely unmet need. One of the issues you have with ibrutinib is the signal of atrial fibrillation. And we've got this patient here whose atrial fibrillation is already poorly controlled.
So he actually had ablations done.
He'd had ablations done. And even with ablations, he still had recurrence of his atrial fibrillation. So if he'd been ablated and his atrial fibrillation was now treated by that ablation, I wouldn't have a concern about using ibrutinib. But this patient came along and we had at the time a clinical trial open with acalabrutinib, which at the time struck us as being a potential use of this agent. And of course, we've got trials ongoing right now, head-to-head acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib. We've certainly got data suggesting that the risk of atrial fibrillation with acalabrutinib looks lower than it is with ibrutinib. I think that has to be fully substantiated, but certainly the data that's emerged doesn't say that atrial fibrillation doesn't occur with acalabrutinib, but it does clearly appear to occur at a lower frequency than we see with ibrutinib. As always, when you're using a drug like this that potentially you're using to minimize one side effect, the one side effect we do see with acalabrutinib that we don't see with ibrutinib are these headaches, which are a feature of getting these patients on. And in some of these patients, it can be quite severe. But again, it's a case of reassuring a patient that whatever the mechanism is, they seem to settle down over time. So if people can kind of manage the headaches during that first, usually 6 to 8 week period, but usually that's kind of the outer end, those headaches will eventually decrease.
And that happened with this man. What did he actually describe to you?
Yeah, he said, I've just got this feeling of fuzziness in my head the whole time. And at times, it, you know, my head's just pounding. So a kind of stress headache is the kind of what people kind of describe. Not a migraine, but kind of bilateral stress-type headache that just won't quite go away.
And now that went away eventually?
Yeah, that settled down. And again, it's a little bit about hand-holding and reassuring somebody, saying like, you know, I promise you this will go away. Just keep persevering. Keep taking the analgesia with the drug meantime. And for him, I think in about 4 weeks, he was just, the headaches had just disappeared.
And his disease responded?
His disease responded very well, and he remains on therapy, and he remains on therapy because, of course, the clinical trial is continuous. So he remains on therapy.
How long has he been on treatment now?
He's been on treatment now for coming up to 4 years, I think. Now.
Wow, 4 years. Yeah. Wow, interesting. Going back, though, to that decision, this man really seemed like he had a serious problem, but others maybe not quite as serious, or maybe they're anticoagulated. What about using venetoclax rituximab in this situation rather than a BTK inhibitor?
Yeah, it's a very, very good point. So I should say that if I hadn't been able to get this patient onto the clinical trial with acalabrutinib, given his circumstances and risk of CLL versus the risk of atrial fibrillation, I would have treated him with ibrutinib anyway. And of course, now I'd also have the choice, although I didn't have it at the time we treated him with acalabrutinib, of going straight to venetoclax rituximab. For a patient who's relapsed, who hasn't had either rituximab or venetoclax before, you've now in the relapse setting got a choice of using ibrutinib versus venetoclax rituximab. And again, then it becomes an issue of, you know, which one do you choose first and which one are you going to go second? I guess in many people's mind, the algorithm still kind of automatically sits of ibrutinib with venetoclax afterwards, because we've got more experience, because ibrutinib came along first, we've got more experience of treating ibrutinib-resistant patients with venetoclax. There's more and more data emerging about doing it the other way around, and people are becoming more comfortable. So now you really have a choice. And then it's going to be about sitting down. And as we had with chemotherapy, you're talking about fixed duration therapy versus indefinite therapy as one issue to consider, and also to start taking into consideration other comorbidities. So is there a relative contraindication to doing this? I've got a patient who's got an absolute contraindication to BTK inhibitors in terms of having a real bleeding risk, in whom it's very clear that venetoclax would be the preferred, is in fact the preferred option. With anticoagulation and BTK inhibitors, it's not an absolute contraindication. You think about the bleeding risk, but the data is overall, there's a bleeding risk there, but it's safe. But it's certainly one of the factors that I would bring into consideration and talk to a patient about in terms of thinking, are you personally a better candidate for venetoclax rather than ibrutinib, as would be a history of atrial fibrillation.
What about the issue of bleeding risk with acalabrutinib? And chemically or biochemically, what's the difference between acalabrutinib and ibrutinib? And what presumably would be the mechanism of different or less toxicity with acalabrutinib?
Whereas I'm quite convinced at the moment that it looks like there's less atrial fibrillation, I don't think of acalabrutinib and ibrutinib of having any different risk in terms of the antiplatelet action and the way in which the drugs work, and therefore no difference in the potential bleeding risk. Now, clearly, that's to be confirmed in the clinical trials, but certainly my experience has been that is acalabrutinib patients have bruising also.
If a patient is on anticoagulation, how do you approach the issue of BTK inhibitors? And to what extent does it depend on the type of anticoagulation?
The whole history of this is that there was the knowledge that these drugs had antiplatelet activity. And there were a couple of reported intracranial bleeds in patients on warfarin. So the early clinical trials of ibrutinib excluded patients on warfarin. And in fact, the European label, but not the US label, has a relative contraindication to the use of warfarin with BTK inhibitors. So almost paradoxically, our approach therefore is to take patients off warfarin and put them on a novel, you know, so a DOAC. And it's kind of counterintuitive to say, well, you know, what's the relative risk? Because what's come out is the risk of bleeding on an anticoagulant isn't really that high. The real risk for these patients of bleeding is the patients on antiplatelet agents, and in particular, those patients on dual antiplatelet agents. So for me, the issue is if somebody's coronary artery disease and the cardiologist has them on dual antiplatelet therapy, and then you add in a BTK inhibitor, that's where the risk of bleeding goes up. And if they're on a dual antiplatelet therapy plus an anticoagulant, and the cardiologist is not happy with you substituting one of those antiplatelet agents with the ibrutinib or acalabrutinib, that for me would be a real indication to move to venetoclax rather than using a BTK inhibitor.
I think you know that one of my favorite things in medicine is how I treat series in blood. And I know you have a paper there on how and when I do allogeneic transplant in CLL. So I recommend everybody to read the paper, but maybe you can sort of give us the bottom line of what you're trying to get across.
So allogeneic stem cell transplant for CLL used to be the only curative approach, and it was the only approach we had for patients like those with 17p deletions. What we've been talking about here is there are now 3 or 4 very good drugs out there which have activity in that disease setting. And what's very clear is that since these drugs have become available, the number of allogeneic stem cell transplants that are being offered has just plummeted. So you could argue right now that ibrutinib and venetoclax have done to transplant in CLL what imatinib did to transplants in CML 20 years ago. Whether or not there's a later resurgence as these people become resistant, I don't know. But what looks very clearly is allogeneic stem cell transplant was a high-risk procedure for these more elderly patients with CLL. And we were doing it because we'd no choice. Now we've got a choice. We're able to offer patients much better treatment approaches. And allogeneic stem cell transplant, at the very least, has been pushed right back into the treatment algorithm compared to where it was just a few years ago.
So you have a 56-year-old man with von Willebrand disease with CLL who you gave adalimumab to. He got pneumonitis. Now he's on venetoclax. You're thinking about allo in this patient. How come?
Well, because he has an absolute contraindication to receiving ibrutinib or acalabrutinib. He has already had idelalisib, and of course I use that because venetoclax wasn't available at the time that he needed it, and he got a period of time from it. And he's now still a young man on potentially his last. So what with him, I'm doing with him is I'm working him up for a transplant for a rainy day, so to speak. If he starts to progress through venetoclax, I don't have another option for him. And under that circumstance, allogeneic stem cell transplant then becomes the only game I have in town. And what I don't want to do is find out that I missed the window of him relapsing from venetoclax and then start thinking about an allogeneic transplant. And by the time I find him a donor, his disease already escaped because I've got nothing to retreat him back into that state. So for me, it's kind of back to where I was with that first patient. I've always liked to have one more option available to me after the one I'm treating now. And fortunately, the field's gone along over the last few years as we just had ibrutinib. Now we've got ibrutinib venetoclax. Now we've got other BTK inhibitors. Now we're talking about combinations. We've always got that next line becoming available. But when you come to the end of those lines, that's when you have to start thinking about going back to what else we've got. And what we've got is, for a young patient, is a potentially curative approach that we shouldn't completely throw away, but it's going to be for these more niche patients that you might have to think about. There's other reasons why they're going to fail.
Have you heard the term CLL is the new CML?
I think what's very clear is that for a lot of us, ibrutinib, wonderful as it is, was never an imatinib. What is ibrutinib venetoclax? Imatinib? Maybe. Maybe it's even better because 20 years later, we still don't know who to stop imatinib for. And we're already stopping patients with the ibrutinib venetoclax combination. So are either of those drugs alone are equivalent of imatinib? I would argue no, but maybe that combination together is going to do it.
Can we chat a little bit about hairy cell leukemia as if, let's say, you're reviewing it for a fellow or a doc who's just come into practice in terms of kind of what we know about the disease and what's new?
Sure. So, I mean, it's a very rare disease. So it's something that you've got to really think about in the first place. It usually presents with relative pancytopenia, and the patients have usually got splenomegaly. I guess the most often symptom I'd see patient complaining about would be tiredness And of course, the differential when you see these sorts of patients can be fairly wide. Clearly, the blood film itself can be very diagnostic, but everyone's seen those pictures and remembers those pictures from your medical school textbooks. But of course, it's not often quite so straightforward there. But the immunophenotypic pattern is very, very characteristic. So once you kind of think about it and your differential, it's not a hard diagnosis to make. The issue, of course, is also the age distribution is such that I think I've pretty much seen patients at every age group, from teenagers all the way to very elderly individuals, often presenting in exactly the same way. And of course, the other big feature about hairy cell leukemia is how well it can respond to therapy. So you're going into it with the expectation that you're going to see a very good response and often very durable. But of course, as with many of these other diseases, that also can lead to some of your own problems in that your patients are then expected to do very well. And then when they do relapse, they're quite disappointed because they've been led to expect it's not something that's going to happen. I guess then we're still talking about, for the vast majority of patients, they'll respond very quickly to second-line therapies. There are brand new things coming along that look really quite good and quite exciting. The issue with any new drug that comes along for a disease like hairy cell leukemia that is rare and is even rarer in terms of relapse is how long it can take to accrue sufficient numbers of patients. And of course, if the regulatory authorities start wanting kind of randomized trials, they're just never going to happen in this kind of disease. So the kind of the regulatory pathway to getting a new drug in itself can be quite difficult. And the expertise that any one individual would have in some of the new therapies for hairy cell leukemia is pretty rare, because every individual only usually sees a handful of these patients, even in the big cancer centres. Obviously, there are a couple of places that really have a kind of major interest in recruiting those sorts of patients. Usually, those are the sorts of places that go ahead and develop the new drugs like the immunoconjugates that came out of, you know, from NCI and from Scripps in the past. There's been big interest in these kinds of diseases. But as always, it's about thinking, how can you use your experience of managing other B-cell malignancies to help those patients through once you've kind of thought about and made the diagnosis?
Can you talk a little bit about what's new in terms of understanding the pathophysiology of the disease, the pathogenesis? I was curious about the alterations that are seen in terms of BRAF mutations.
Sure, absolutely. And of course, highly relevant in terms of there being BRAF inhibitors that can be used. And another example where, you know, you can use a drug designed for other indications once you understand the pathophysiology and you have access to inhibitors that are able to hit particular pathways. It's very commonly affected, but of course not invariably affected. So again, you have to know if you're going to use those sorts of inhibitors that the patient has that mutation for it to be able to respond.
And is this the same sort of V600E mutation that's seen in melanoma and lung cancer, for example?
Yeah, it's very similar, but the place in which the mutations can occur, they largely cluster, but they can be outside that area. So it's about making sure you've got the assay that incorporates where the mutation is likely to be, but also to incorporate some of the other exons where mutations might be and be thinking about, is a patient going to have that mutation to be able to target it?
What's your typical first-line therapy for patients, and what kinds of issues do you run into? You were talking about cytopenias.
Sure. So deoxycomycin or pentostatin can be used. Most people would like to use rituximab with it, so a chemoimmunotherapy type approach. The issue is, of course, both those agents do cause, in the short term, worsening of the cytopenias. The issue of how much benefit you add from rituximab, my own experience has been I tend to look to use it. I can hardly think of B-cell malignancies where I don't find the addition of an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody is beneficial. And again, you've got some individuals that say, you know, where's the hard and fast clinical trial data? And we've already talked about the fact that in these very rare diseases, that data can often be missing. But I tend to think that I'm looking to get, you know, a one-off approach to maximize the cure rate as much as possible. So I do use an anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody with it.
And in general, what do you see as the cure rate? And in people who relapse, at what point do you generally see them relapse?
Sure. So, I mean, I'd be talking to a patient expecting to say, you know, 80 to 90% of the patients are not going to relapse. The relapses can occur almost at any time. And one of the issues you do sometimes see is these very late relapses occurring in individuals who, of course, think they've put the disease behind them and think they're already cured and it's not going to come back. And we have talked about the fact that sometimes these people do find it very disappointing to find a disease that's behind them as possible. Those patients, as an Aubrey setting, who relapse earlier often can then have a shorter duration of response to just moving or repeating the first line therapy, as you'd see in any other B-cell malignancy. And it's those sorts of patients in whom you're looking for a more novel approach, either, you know, immunotoxins or looking for BRAF mutations to see whether or not you can add in other agents for that. The other group of patients you think about there are people who've gone through this multiply relapsing pattern where clearly they've acquired mechanisms of chemotherapy drug resistance.
And what are some of the options that are in consideration in terms of second line therapy? And what are the clinical data that we have to support their use? Maybe starting out with the obvious, which would be BRAF inhibitors or BRAF-MEK as is used in other diseases.
Sure. So if you have a BRAF mutation, the likelihood in hairy cell leukemia of responding to that inhibitor is actually very high. As always, we're a little bit lacking durations of responses in that they haven't been tested for that long. And certainly when I go to ASH and ASCO, those are the sorts of sessions I like to go along to see what's the longer term follow-up of those groups of patients. You tend to see the publications arising in the papers with a very, very short follow-up. So you see very high response rates. But the big question is, as you're kind of already alluding to, is what's the duration of response and how really durable are those? The data that I've seen suggests that, you know, in some individuals, it can be very durable indeed. The big question, of course, is why are some patients relapsing more quickly than others? And are they developing additional mutations that bypass the BRAF pathway itself? That's kind of much more poorly understood.
What are some of the other alternatives, both clinically as well as in research, that are considered with relapse disease? What about BTK inhibitors, ibrutinib?
There's relatively little data out there on the BTK inhibitors in this setting. As always, there's a handful of these sorts of patients that are within clinical trials, and you tend to hear about the anecdotal cases that respond well to it, and you hear about them. What you never know in those circumstances is what was the denominator. That is, you know, how many people tried the drug and didn't respond. So I'd say that, yes, there's a possibility that patients could respond, but identifying who is and who isn't going to respond is something I think we lack at the present time.
So you mentioned this, I guess it's an antibody drug conjugate, moxetumomab pasudotox. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and what we know about it in hairy cell?
What you're talking about here, of course, is an antibody that has with it a toxin which is internalized inside the cell. It's a very attractive proposition to be saying that you're taking a poison just to the cells that you're looking to target. And of course, it's a receptor that isn't present in normal B cells. So you're not looking to immune deplete the patient the way you do with other antibodies. So it's all of these issues. The immunotoxins are attractive. It's particularly attractive in hairy cell leukemia because you're talking here about a disease where you're looking to treat the patient once and have a high response rate. One of the big problems with immunotoxins is that they are themselves immunogenic. And when you go back and look to be trying to retreat patients at the later time points, people can have antibodies against the compound itself. So by using it in a way in which you're treating a disease where a one-off type treatment is going to lead to long-term eradication, a big problem with immunotoxins is where you might have to consider going back and retreating in the future.
Now, when you say immunotoxin, is it essentially a similar mechanism, you know, the drug that we're very familiar with, brentuximab vedotin?
Yeah, so same principle, different toxin, but it's a very similar principle, yeah.
But this idea, I haven't never heard anybody say that about B vedotin. Do you see this sort of immune thing that you're talking?
No, you don't tend to see it the same way, but certainly lots of the original immunotoxin compounds, people were using them again in the future was more difficult. I think also a lot of probably the earlier technology, there was much more concern about the release of the compound off the antibody. The linker technology is such that these toxins are much more stably bound to the antibody, and maybe that explains why you're getting less free toxin released to become immunogenic. But you're right. I haven't seen patients with brentuximab having problems with antibody responses against the immunotoxin at later time points.
What about tolerability or toxicity issues? Obviously, with bevacizumab, we hear about peripheral neuropathy. What about with this agent?
Yeah, I haven't. Certainly, again, I've got very limited experience of using it, but in the patients that I have seen with it, there was not issues with peripheral neuropathy. It was very well tolerated, which is one of the issues that made it an attractive option.
And what about efficacy?
Yeah, it's very highly efficacious. As always, when you see the results of the clinical trials, you're never quite sure what the selection criteria is in terms of how selected were those patients that went on to the clinical trials. But no, very highly efficacious. And as always, of course, the clinical trials have been in the relapse and refractory patient population. You always wonder about how much more efficacious these agents could be if you took it much earlier in treatment.
And is this agent used indefinitely until toxicity or progression, or you just sort of give it and stop?
You give it and stop, yeah, because you look like you, again, you eradicate the disease clone fairly readily, yeah.